Just ask Satchmo about Bix. He'll say, tell the whole world there'll never be another Bix Biterbeck. He was a born genius, but they crowded him too much with love. This is Bix, a biographical series made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and produced by Miami University Radio. The last recording Bix Biterbeck did with the Wolverines was on October 7, 1924, the session in which Tijuana was cut. Big Boy, which was released as side two of Tijuana, was also cut on that date. Big Boy strongly accentuates the idea that Bix was growing away from the group. In this tune, Bix plays both the cornet and the piano. There's a phrase after Bix's first cornet solo, which is carried completely by the ensemble work of the other members of the Wolverines. And then the piano comes in. We can guess that Bix started playing on the cornet with the group, and after his first solo on the cornet, he moved to the piano. And he probably carried his horn with him to the piano bench, as there's only a short pause between the last piano phrase and the first cornet tones. Big Boy, the last record of Bix and the Wolverines. Thank you. Jazz buff Frank Powers comments on Big Boy.
Big Boy was another pop tune of the day, written by Jack Yellen and Milton Ager, better known for having given us that immortal classic, Hard-Hearted Hannah. And in this particular instance, I think we hear what was probably the final crowning achievement of the Wolverines. Certainly, at no time was Bix more inventive with his particular band than his chorus and his lead playing on this particular recording. It also has a unique feature of the first piano solo by Beiderbecke to appear on records, and it's notable that after the piano solo is over, the clarinet and saxophone are heard playing ensemble without aid of cornet, and Bix sort of eases his way in after about four bars of ensemble work, giving ample evidence that he was moving from a piano bench to take up his position cornet-wise.
Through his experience with the Wolverines, and particularly their records, Bix Beiderbecke's gift for music obviously was not common. Bix grew with each record. In October of 1924, he left the Wolverines for good, but not before he'd auditioned and trained his own replacement. Jimmy McPartland remembers the first time he heard the Wolverines. McPartland was one of the Austin High Gang in Chicago, a group which has given the world several jazz greats. He shares his first impressions of the Wolverines.
The first time we were playing Boats Going... we heard the records. That's right, the records out at Austin High School. On the Jeanette Records, the Wolverines. Oh, I've forgotten the name of the numbers. Something like Copenhagen and Old Baby and Riverboat Shuffle and the likes. And we flipped. We heard Bix. Of course, previous to that, we were influenced by the New Orleans Rhythm Kings and then King Oliver and Louis Armstrong. But what we heard the Wolverines, well, it was really a wow. Something, especially with Bix in there, that beautiful tone. And, well, he was playing with such a great drive and swing, you know, and beautiful notes. He was playing such lovely, well, his harmonies, you know, they were beautiful notes, and they hit you, you know, inside. We imitated all the ensembles and their little arrangements, but when it came time to do any solos, why, it was a standing rule with us that we had to play our own solo. In other words, you don't copy a guy's solo when you play a solo. You just play your own solo.
When the Wolverines found that they would need a new cornet player, they interviewed several prospects. Finally, Vic Moore called young McPartland in Illinois. Jimmy describes that call and his reactions to it. He also remembers his first meeting with Bix.
Yeah, I was going to school, and I got a wire at home. A guy by the name of Vic Moore, the drummer, had heard me play on a New Year's Eve previous to that, and he had been with the Wolverines before, and he flipped. He said, "Guy, you sound like Bix, man." You know, I said, "Well, we've been playing the records and, you know, play the numbers off the records and so forth." And so when he got to New York to rejoin the Wolverines again on drums, as I say, his name was Vic Moore, well, he evidently told Dick Voino and all the guys in the band, you know, because Bix was leaving to join the Gene Colquitt Orchestra. And an excellent job. And so they tried out some other trumpet players, but I got a wire from Dick Voino and said, "Can you join the Wolverines replacing Bix Beiderbecke, $87.50 per week, Cinderella Ballroom?" Answer, you know. So I thought it was a gag. We all thought it was a joke, you know. It's too big of an honor, we thought. And so all the guys, the Teschmacher, and my brother Dick and Benny Goodman was with us at that time, too, said, "Well, answer anyway, see what happens." So I bless Benny, he says, "Ask him for transportation." So I saw the wire and said, "Yes, send transportation." And so I got a money order the next day, and I left, I guess, the following day after that, and they all saw me off down to the train down there in LaSalle Street Station, I remember. And God, it took me about 3 days to get there. I didn't know, I'd never traveled before, you know. So I took like a milk train, literally. And finally got there, and Dick Voino, oh no, they said come right to the Somerset Hotel in the Wire, which I did. So Dick Voino, and then we went over in the afternoon and had a rehearsal, and I still hadn't met Bix. And we had a rehearsal, and he said, well, what do you want to play? And I said, I don't care, Riverboat Shuffle, Copenhagen, anything you guys play from the records. Okay, well, they beat it off the way we went, and they were very happy, because I knew the arrangements, and the proper key, and the right key, and when it came time for my solos, I played my own solo. I was a little nervous, but I must say in those days, at 17 years old, I was rather cocky, like the usual 17-year-old monkey. So, after the rehearsal, Bix made himself known. I asked, where's Bix? He said, he's out there. And then I said, oh, boy. So I met Bix, and that's when he told me, you know, that he liked me because I don't copy him, but I sound like him. And they arranged it for me to, because Bix only had a week more to stay with the band, with the Wolverines there, and then he was going to go with Gene Golcat. And so Dick Voino, the leader, said, well, you guys get a double room together, you know, with twin beds, and Bix will show you the arrangements on the other tunes that we have, which he did. So during the daytime, before we ended, we worked together for 1 week. And he'd show, you know, show me, and when I'd play first on the things, well, he'd sort of go along and play second cornet, but he showed me the arrangements, the introductions and endings and so forth, you know, little interludes or key changes and deals like that. It was all what they called head arrangements. Nothing was written down. And that was it.
Jimmy McPartland provides an insight into young Beiderbecke's personality through his recollections of Bix, his generosity, his forgetfulness, his all-consuming love of music. What kind of a guy was Bix Beiderbecke?
What kind of a guy was he? He wasn't... He was rather reserved. I mean, he didn't talk an awful lot. He'd answer questions civilly and to people, but if you weren't interested in music, why, forget it. Tennis, he did like tennis. He was a tennis player. And he enjoyed sports and things like that, but it was really all music. He was just dedicated to music completely. And... And in those days, of course, I should mention, and it's truthful, that it was during Prohibition, and it was more or less the thing to do was to have a bottle on your hip, you know, a pint bottle of gin. And so we used to do quite a bit of drinking. Gin, Prohibition gin, bathtub gin, yeah. But actually, it's kind of hard to say the kind of a guy Bix was. I mean, as I say, I mean, that's, it was music, 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 all the time. And that's about, I mean, we didn't talk about much else, you know.
Is it true that Bix got you a new cornet when you joined the Wolverines?
Yes, when I first came at that afternoon rehearsal, I had a old Harry B.J. cornet, and the valves would make a clank, clank sound and everything. They were, it was pretty worn out horn. And so the Dick Voino said, Bix, take Jimmy over to Kahn's, and because he was playing a Victor model at that time. He says, take Jimmy over to Kahn's and get him a new horn. And he says, you kid, I'll take it, you know, $10 a week out of your salary, you know, until it's paid up. So we went over there, and Bix tried two or three of them, and picked out one, and that was it. So we traded in the old Harry B.J., and I had a nice new Kahn Victor model cornet. And then later on, a few years later, by the way, when he was with Whiteman, and we were in Chicago, I should say that was about two and a half years later, he came in, was at the Chicago, they were with the Chicago Theater. I got an early morning call about 7 or 8 o'clock out at my house out in Austin, and it was Bix. He said, hey, kid, he said, have you got a tuxedo? I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm down at Chicago Theater, and I left mine in Detroit. And he said, will you bring it down for me? I said, sure, I did. I brought it down, gave it to him. That's the last I saw of it, by the way. I never did ask for it back. You know, he just forgot. However, what happened was they were there for a week or two, I can't recall, at the Chicago Theater, a marvelous band. The Rhythm Boys were with them too, Jimmy Dorsey, Tommy Dorsey, Bing Crosby, and a lot of wonderful guys. Gee. And we used to have jam sessions every afternoon, every night over to a speakeasy called the Three Deuces on State Street there, 222 North State. And we'd go downstairs and they had a piano and we'd have jam sessions after every show. It was just marvelous. So Vix, at that time, whenever I'd come around, he'd say, "Hey kid, you play the cornet because I want to play the piano." All right? You know, I said, "Sure." So he says, "I want you to try this new horn I've got." He says, "It's a beauty. It's really something." So it was a Bach. So I tried it and I just fell in love with it, you know. It was a beautiful horn. So the next day he says, "Why don't you get yourself one?" I said, "I haven't got any money." You know, I don't think I was working at the time. So something was going on. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, meet me after the next show." He said, "We'll go over to the Dixie Music House." He said, "You got some over there." So we went over there, and I think the horn cost $175, and he planked down $125. He had about $125 in cash. He just pulled out the money and says, "Here." He says, "Kid, you sign for it, and the rest of it you can, you know, you ask the guy to pay off $5 a month, $5 a week, something like that." So he picked this horn out for me, and he says, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He says, "We're going to St. Louis for a week, and we're coming back through here." He says, "You take my horn. I'll break this one in for you in St. Louis, and when we come back, I'll give it to you." So that's exactly what happened. He played it for a week, and I played his horn. He came back, and we switched again, and that was it. So I still have that horn. I believe that tells you what kind of a guy Bix was. That's what he did. If he liked you, man, you can have anything. Money didn't mean anything to him. He wanted to see me have a good horn, and that was it.
And so as Bix left the Wolverines in New York, an era of jazz came to a close. Frank Powers offers his evaluation of the importance of the Wolverines in jazz history.
It's been said by some jazz critics that there are three great early white jazz bands in the history of jazz. They are the original Dixieland Jazz Band. They were from New Orleans. The New Orleans Rhythm Kings, who were also from New Orleans, but did contain in the band several Chicago musicians. And lastly, the Wolverines Orchestra. The Wolverines were unique in that no one came from New Orleans. They were all middle western white youngsters from pretty much middle class backgrounds. What they achieved from their influence with us other bands was unique in that they were the first ones to move beyond the basic blues and ragtime harmonics. And the reason they did was because Bix was in the band. Could be said for no other reason. And the market and the influence of this band was to be felt in jazz up even into the early 30s. The new type of approach to ensemble playing, a new awareness of the importance of harmonic improvisation, the total independence of the blues structure, which was considered a travesty by many other connoisseurs of jazz in later years, was probably their most unique contribution. In other words, this was the beginning of white jazz on its own as a valid form, as a creative kind of music, completely independent from the Negro jazz of that period. Points of reference to beginning to develop already to European Impressionism. Many people would classify this as decadence. I classify this personally as the honest development of people playing music from their own basic resources. And the era had passed. Weiderbeck would probably never again, as a full-time avocation, play in the small band or semi-Dixieland style. It was the end of an era.
Soon after Bix's last recording session with the Wolverines, he joined with a pickup group to cut I'm Glad. October 10 saw the first recorded efforts of Bix with Frank Trombauer, the first professional association of the now legendary Bix Tram Team. Frank Powers discusses the group, the Sioux City Six, and their recording.
Bix's first appearance on recordings after the final recordings of the Wolverines was with a pickup band called the Sioux City Six. These recordings were made in New York City on the 10th of October, 1924, and they feature, in addition to Bix, Miff Mole on trombone, Frankie Trumbauer on C melody saxophone, and Rube Bloom on piano. Min Leebrook, the tuba player from the Wolverines, is present, as is Vic Moore, the drummer from that band. Now, with the presence of these three musicians, Mole, Trumbauer, and Bloom, we find Bix now in the company of some of the elite of white jazz of that time. This was the first recording date with Bix and Frank Trumbauer together, and it was to forecast this partnership, which was to bring about a great records sessions to be held in 1927. Miff Mole has been an established star for a number of years, having made a series of recordings with the original Memphis Five and other groups. Rube Bloom was to become one of the piano impressionists of that period, composing many numbers such as Soliloquy, which were quite well known in their time, and which parallel some of the same thinking that Bix had, only not on as highly a developed plane, I would suppose you'd say. Flock of Blues, the first number, is a composition of Frank Trumbauer. You find Bix playing rather conservatively on this date, probably because he was aware that he was among musicians that had already made somewhat of a reputation. I'm Glad is a composition of Rube Bloom. Oftentimes you'll notice that Bix sort of surrenders the lead to Frank Trumbauer momentarily and goes to an embellishing sort of line. This may be indicative of the fact that at that time, to many, the role of cornet and saxophone, which one was to be the lead instrument, had not yet been clearly defined. And so we do hear Bix surrendering to the saxophone, probably by mutual agreement on several times on both sides of the recording. You hear Miff Mole and Rube Bloom and Trumbauer playing in a manner that suggests that already they were under the influence of Bix.
And the record? I'm Glad. Thank you. Sioux City Six session was Bix's first venture without the Wolverines. He returned to Chicago in November and was hired by Charlie Strait. He played with Strait's orchestra at the Rendezvous Cafe. Bix's inability to read music or to follow arrangements lost him his job in Chicago. Beiderbecke then went on to his contract with Gene Goldkett. During this time, he continued to work occasionally with Frankie Trombauer. Bix and Tram. This is Bix, a biographical series made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Consultants for the series were John Steiner, along with Joseph Campbell and Philip Evans. Commentary was recorded by Frank Powers. Continuity was written by Mary Kay Fulton. Audio engineer, Michael J. McGuire. Bix was researched, produced, and directed by Jim Grover. This is Bill Utter speaking for Miami University Radio.
Limited rights for this rebroadcast of Bix on WMKV 89.3 FM Cincinnati were given by WMUB FM, Miami University Broadcasting in Oxford, Ohio, courtesy of WMUB FM General Manager Cleve Collison. WMUB FM originally produced the program for broadcast in 1971. Any rebroadcast, internet streaming, or archiving of this program by anyone other than WMKV is prohibited. WMKV would like to thank the original producer of the program, Jim Grover, for his vision and efforts to preserve this unique chapter in the history of jazz, authored by Bix, and Mr. Bill Utter, Director Emeritus of Miami University Broadcasting, who conceived the original program idea, narrated the original series, and has been instrumental in making this rebroadcast possible. Dave Bartholomew, volunteer and host of the WMKV weekly program Friction, deserves special thanks for his labor of love in remastering Bix. The advisory group that oversaw the project to rebroadcast Bix include Frank Powers, commentator on the original series, Dave Bartholomew, Bill Utter, Cleve Collison, WMUB General Manager, Dave Schramm, WMKV Coordinator of Online Services, Mike Farrar, WMKV Coordinator of Production Services, Joe Schooner, WMKV Intern from the University of Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, Media Division, and Alan Bayosky, WMKV General Manager. Please stay tuned for the best in big band era music right here on WMKV, the way radio was meant to be.